Medical Mutual wants to remind you it's almost time for Medicare's annual enrollment period. As a trusted health insurer for more than 90 years, Medical Mutual is here to help you find better Medicare benefits. Be confident you're getting the most from your Medicare Advantage plan. Schedule your free Medicare plan review today at medmutual.com/review. Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina, who's covering the NBA at 538 and GQ. Michael, barn burner last night. Just a big one. The Houston Rockets sent Russell Westbrook to the Washington Wizards for John Wall and a protected first-round pick. This sort of deal was rumored a couple weeks ago. It was the kind of deal that I had created in my head when John Wall first got injured like 2 years ago as one of the only possible escape routes for Washington from his contract. But I assumed there was going to be 5-6 first-round picks attached to just kind of make that thing happen. Lo and behold, it was a case of both teams and I think both ownership groups just feeling like it was time to move on, that they couldn't salvage relationships on both sides. And so they sort of traded problems in a way. I think we saw in the last couple of weeks, Russell Westbrook won out, John Wall won out. Very tricky tap dancing from the Wizards and the media about whose team is it, and it was John Wall in the rumors, and he's trying to no comment the trade rumors and everything else. It was just an untenable situation, I think, for the Wizards side of things. And I think in Houston, it just continues what's been just a remarkable collapse here over the last couple of months. So I'm curious, Michael, when you're stepping back from the wreckage of this trade, which I think a lot of people not only view it as a pretty big deal, but also just kind of hilarious and fun, right? It's like, whoa, what? A straight up star trade, both injured, both disgruntled, both on huge contracts, both polarizing player types, I think, as well. Do you have a winner? Did anyone win? No one won? Who came out on top here?
I mean, this was, I would not say anyone won this trade. This was a super sad transaction. I mean, two guys who in their primes were absolutely electrifying, and because of age-related decline and serious injury, they just aren't the same guys or are projected not to be the same guys. I guess there's a little bit of mysterious intrigue with Wall in particular because we haven't seen him really play basketball in about 2 years almost, it feels like. So he could be good. Like, you don't know. I mean, KD came out the other day and said that he was playing pickup with John Wall. John Wall looked terrific. Who knows if that is accurate? So, I mean, if I had to say who won the trade, I would say Houston because they got a first-round pick for Westbrook, which I think, you know, I don't think anybody thought was possible after the debacle in the bubble and how he played, even though there's pretty good reason for how he played. But, you know, 32 years old with the money that he's due, to get a first-round pick for an organization that had given up two future firsts plus two pick swaps to get him, I think that that is a pretty good way to salvage that transaction. But, I mean, I wouldn't say that they're big winners here. It's just a really sad state of affairs.
So when I look at the winners of this trade, I almost view it as that meme where like the brain gets more and more complicated and eventually you get down to like the galaxy brain take, right? So I think like the most obvious winner, right, off the top would be Washington because Westbrook's a better and more reliable player, a more productive player. And so when you go into next season, you're saying, look, there are odds of making the playoffs. The chances that he's going to be able to take over in the Eastern Conference and do his thing and make an all-star team and everything like that is better than Wall's chances of doing the same. So therefore, mm-hmm. Washington wins in the short term. I think the second stage up would be what you're describing, which is like, well, actually, neither one of these guys is that great. They don't really qualify as a plan at this point in their careers. So the best asset that got traded was actually the pick. So if you got the pick, you're the winner. That's the next level up. My galaxy brain take is that Wall's risk of re-injury, not only because of the Achilles, which was sort of like a back-to-back surgery situation when he got it 2 years ago, but also because of his prior knee injuries, which were, dogging him, I guess, for years, frankly, before even mm-hmm. the Achilles came along, is so grave that moving his contract is actually better than a first-round pick. And if you imagine a scenario in this season where he does get re-injured in any sort of a meaningful way, the cost to move the remaining balance of his contract is going to be a lot higher than that first-round pick. So Houston just basically backed themselves into a corner. So once it's all done, once I reach the galaxy brain level of winners and losers in my analysis, Michael, I think Washington won because they were able to get rid of Wall's contract, which to me was still among the very worst in the NBA, even though there was only 3 years left on it, simply because of his very, very heightened risk of re-injury. Now, I'm not Russell Westbrook's biggest fan. I think Russell Westbrook going to Washington is not a clean basketball win. I think you're going to find situations very early on where everyone's looking around and saying, why is Westbrook doing so much and Bradley Beal's not doing enough? Can we just give the ball to Beal? He's so much more efficient. He's such a better initiator of the offense for his teammates. Why is Westbrook getting in the way? And so I do think that there's going to be complications on the court. I think there's a reasonable ceiling to this group trying to push into the playoff mix just because the standard is so low there in the Eastern Conference to kind of get into that 6-7-8 seed range that Washington should be a little bit more of a factor there. But I'm not saying this is a win on basketball terms. I'm saying this is a win on long-term financial and risk assessment. And just, you know, it was time to pull the plug after 10 years with Wall, and things got pretty dicey. And if you're able to get off that contract and pass that risk to somebody else, then you wind up coming out on top.
So I guess let's address this real quick. I want to address this real quick from Washington's perspective and kind of push back a little bit on what you're trying to say here. One of the interesting points that I haven't seen brought up too much on NBA Twitter or in any articles I've read about the deal are that the age difference in these players, which is something that we normally would, you know, bring up right away. Wall is 2 full years younger than Westbrook, even though both of their contracts extend for the next 3 seasons. So I think that even though Wall had, I mean, they both have had.
Here's the way I look at it, Michael. I mean, I'm in my 30s, but I think most of the listeners would agree. You know, I'm in my 30s going on my 80s, right? I'm a pretty boring guy. Like, you know, I'm a little bit more advanced. I mean, I think with Wall's injury history, he might be 30, but, you know, he's 30 going on 35. You know what I mean?
And, right. No, that's totally fair. They both have had, I think, major surgeries, and Westbrook is coming off a muscle tissue issue in his thigh that was, you know, really prevented him from being a productive player. I mean, he hijacked Houston in the bubble in a lot of really detrimental ways. But I think one of the other key points here is the fit, obviously, between Westbrook and Beal, because if you're Washington, Bradley Beal is everything still. Like, keeping him happy, re-signing him once his current contract expires. They still seem to want to build around him, and they should. He's an incredible basketball player who averaged 30 points per game last season. Based on what we know with Westbrook, now I'm not disregarding Wall's relationship with Beal, which has been, you know, described as pretty murky over the years. But Westbrook, you know, someone who needs the ball, obviously. Someone who wants the ball, obviously. Someone who is a little, I think, delusional, a little more delusional than I thought he was based on some of the statements that he's recently made.
Michael, the truth is coming out once he's not on your Houston Rockets. I love it. Keep going.
Fair enough. If keeping Beal happy is the objective here, is Russell Westbrook really your answer? I could just see this blowing up in their face in a really bad way. And with Washington, are they rebuilding? Like, what are they even doing? This is the weirdest. Like, usually with an NBA team, you're kind of able to see where they are in their life cycle. But, like, what are the expectations for this team in the short and long term? It's so impossible to say. This is just confounding and has broken my brain.
Okay, so here's how I look at it. First of all, it's kind of similar to what happened exactly last year, where Russell Westbrook was the baby to try to save the marriage, right? It's the same situation. Like, he hops in here in Washington, and their most immediate priority was resolving the tension between Bradley Beal and John Wall. John Wall was the franchise player. He gets injured. Bradley Beal ascends to being the franchise player. Beal has every reason to believe he should still be the franchise player, and John Wall, like a lot of players who suffer career-altering injuries, just expects that once he gets back on the court, things are going to be how it was 2 years ago. And that was just not going to be the case. And I think it was a situation where Wall was struggling to grapple with the idea he would even be in trade talks, because he remembers being the guy who lifted a Washington Wizards franchise out of some really, really bad years early in his career into the playoffs, basically four times. So I think that, you know, he's feeling a little bit slighted in terms of how the team was, you know, handed off to Beal during his absence. And I think Beal is saying, like, look, I earned it. You know, you were out for 2 years and I carried this whole show by myself. So what do you want? I don't see any way that that tension was going to be resolved, because Wall, much like Westbrook, is a very stubborn, strong-minded guy, you know, and he's always been his own biggest advocate. You go back to USA basketball snubbings, you go back to, you know, declaring that he and Beal were the best backcourt in the NBA. I mean, John Wall, to his credit, thinks very highly of himself and has viewed himself as an elite player. And I think that the odds he was going to be able to get back and consistently play on that level and strike a right balance with Beal this year was just not going to happen. And I think once you let the personality and the emotions into it, that's why Washington felt like they had to kind of move forward. You know, at the same time, a lot of those same issues could exist with Westbrook, as you're pointing out. I think you're absolutely right to point that out. I think if you're Washington, you're trying to have it both ways here. You have to send a message to Bradley Beal that you're trying to win in the short term. And I think you can make a pretty strong case that Westbrook's going to help you do that more than Wall would, even if he's not really going to turn you into some sort of an Eastern Conference power, right? If it doesn't work, you're also setting yourself up for a situation where, whether it's next summer or another year down the road, then you're cashing out Beal and you're going into your rebuilding mode full on with some of these younger players, and hopefully you're getting some really good draft picks in a Beal trade, and then you're just auctioning off Westbrook to anybody who's going to take him, probably the New York Knicks, right, in another year or two once this thing gets even darker. I think that's sort of the path that you're having. I think that Washington had to be realistic with itself. Like, there wasn't going to be a scenario where, I mean, you remember a couple years ago when it was Wall, Beal, and Porter, and they were like all top five picks, right? I believe their jersey numbers were even 1, 2, and 3, if I'm not mistaken. And it was this idea of like, hey, if things broke right, these guys could reach the conference finals if they could add another piece or two around that group, right? Those days are so long gone. And I think what this trade signifies is like, look, we're not trying to cling to the past. We're not trying to recapture any of that momentum. We're admitting that we're basically Bradley Beal and a bunch of young guys who haven't really proven anything. And we're going to hope, we're going to ride the Westbrook roller coaster for a year. And we're going to see what happens once we get to the end of it next summer. And if we have to pull the plug, then you pull the plug at that point. I think they were really just trying to avoid the absolute worst case scenario, which is Wall gets re-injured, he goes back to being completely untradeable, and then Beal just says, you know what, I tried, I need out. And then you're in a tough leverage position. So I do believe this current situation is better than that very real alternate history. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I mean, I'm right now, I'm just looking at Westbrook's statistics from last season, and I'm comparing them with Bradley Beal's, because it's weird to think about this, but like, Westbrook made the All-NBA. I know there's some recency bias because of just how poorly he played in the bubble, but like, this guy made the All-NBA team last year. He averaged 27, 8, and 7, had the exact same usage rate as Bradley Beal did on a team that had no other options, which I think is really fascinating.
Well, here's what, like, I want you to do, Michael. Can you do something for me right now? It's obviously an audio, sure, audio format, but can you actually, yes, take both of your hands and put your palms away from your body up in front of your chest? Okay. Are you doing that for me? Okay. Now,
yes,
now I want you to raise both of your arms over your head, and I want you to wave them back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, right? And now I want you to have a confused look on your face, right? Now, you have just been Denny Abdia for the next 7 months, okay? You're never getting the ball. These guys might not even know your name by the time the All-Star break comes around, and you're going to watch these two guys do their thing one-on-one. Yeah, look, the usage rate part is a huge problem. I think that Beal, no doubt, is a better player than Westbrook at this stage of their career. I think the fact that he was there first is going to give him a little bit like of an incumbent's advantage. But Westbrook, is going to be Westbrook no matter where you put him. He's going to play his game, especially if he's got Scott Brooks there who understands exactly what he's about. And I think they're going to try to turn him loose, and they'll probably stagger the minutes, I would guess, to try to give Beal as much breathing room as possible. But the idea of Westbrook doing too much, being inefficient with the shot, and you know, kind of compromising the development of the young players are very real risks. At the same time, they do have some shooters, you know, so it's possible you're going to get a couple good months of monster stats. And personally, I wouldn't be surprised at all if he makes the All-Star team. What about you?
Well, as you like to say, I mean, this is the JV conference, and so anything is possible there.
So two All-Stars in the backcourt sounds great, Michael. Why aren't you more excited?
Well, I mean, as we saw last season, and it hasn't been corrected by any personnel decisions, this defense was absolutely atrocious. You add Westbrook, who, you know, takes plays off pretty liberally on that end. And
quarters off, like, or plays?
And, like, one of the, I mean, the impetus for Houston deciding to go small and trade for Robert Covington last year was because Russell Westbrook's shot had fallen apart and deteriorated to a degree that was just entirely untenable for him to stand on the perimeter without the basketball. And so, like, the Washington Wizards aren't really built that way. Like, Robin Lopez shot 38% on corner threes last year with Milwaukee, but he took like 50 of them. You know, what are they going to do with regards to spacing? They do have Bertans. Well, they do have some other shooting, but like, what are they going to do here?
So I think the spacing is not their biggest problem. I think you hit it on it earlier. I think it's the defense, because you've got Thomas Bryant, who can shoot the three ball a little bit, and he's been working on that. You've got Bertans, right? And then you've got Rui, who is going to at least be comfortable somewhat on the perimeter. And you've got Denny, who's used to being
sold.
You've got Denny, who's used to being kind of like a perimeter, like, you know, a typical international player, like trying to, you know, play outside in. You put all those guys together as your front court with Beal, you've got space. The problem is none of those guys are positive defenders. In fact, they're all minus defenders, every single one of those guys. So, you know, Westbrook, he might be able to get a lot of dunks, and he might be able to put up a lot of stat lines and do some drive and kick stuff and, you know, have his highlights and everything else. But it's going to be incredibly, incredibly empty calories, because, you know, they're not going to be able to stop anyone again. So I think that is their biggest issue. I'm not even sure they're going to be that entertaining to watch. I mean, personally, I don't love the Russell Westbrook experience as a viewer. I just tend to focus too much on the decision making and the mistakes and, you know, the player control fouls and the turnovers and all that, and the missed shots and all that stuff. There will be highlights, but I just think it's going to feel a little bit empty, because it's not going to be a balanced team, and because it's going to be a lot of, you know, guys going one-on-one and just trying to do their own thing. So maybe they'll prove me wrong. We'll see. I'm not super duper high on them. I think they have a chance to sneak into the playoffs. I saw Kevin Pelton say today in his analysis that he wasn't even sure that that was true, that they might still have just not improved themselves enough to even be in that mix. Where do you come down on that one? Is this a playoff team?
You know, the is this a playoff team question is so fascinating now because of the play-in tournaments.
Oh, right. Everybody's a playoff team, right?
Exactly. It's ridiculous. So, I mean, sure, they could make the playoffs. I mean, when you have someone like Westbrook, assuming he's healthy, assuming that they develop some type of chemistry where, like, I can imagine Brad Beal is someone who likes to come off the ball. He's not like a Trae Young or like a Harden in the way he functions on offense. So maybe the fit isn't that terrible offensively, and they develop some chemistry where Westbrook has the ball in his hands the majority of the time when both are on the court. But, like, I don't know, like, in a playoff, in a one game tournament situation, or where they need to win two in a row, having those nuclear talents on your side is pretty good for Washington. So I could see them sliding in the back door of the postseason. But, like, I also like the Hawks. I guess the Pacers are locked maybe to make the, I don't even know. Like, the Eastern Conference is such a mess. Sure, they could make the playoffs. It wouldn't shock me.
Yeah. I mean, I think Orlando is probably coming back. I think Pacers are probably coming back a little bit. You know, Atlanta's definitely hopping up. Washington, I would say, is hopping up here a little bit. They should be better than last year. And they should be at least in that play-in mix. If they're not, I mean, what an utter disaster. But look, who knows? I mean, this organization's been through a lot the last 10 years. Can we switch this around the other way? to yes. Houston's side, because I know they were your title pick. They add a five-time All-Star point guard in John Wall, Michael. Is that enough to put them over the top? Are they going to win the title?
Can I cut you off for 2 seconds? Okay,
please.
They're not my title pick. Okay, I had a weak moment, I think, on the pod in our last episode where I said that I was leaning towards potentially picking them.
Michael, I got to say, though, it's so much more fun to picture you over there plotting to replace Lucky the Leprechaun, the Celtics mascot, while you pick the Rockets literally every year to win the title no matter what happens. I think it's a great bit. I think you should stick with it. Okay, so in all seriousness, if you look at Houston after all these moves, they got Christian Wood. I think both of us would give that big thumbs up, right? I mean, even at the price, you know, there was a little bit of a last-minute haggling that made his price go up. It's a clean fit, exactly what they need, you know, longer-term piece. They lose Westbrook. They add Wall. They still have P.J. Tucker. They still have Eric Gordon. They lose Covington by trade. They lose Austin Rivers. They still have Daniel House, who apologized for the House affair during the bubble at his opening media day. And they lose their coach, they lose their GM, bring in first-timers at both of those spots. How good is this team? What's Harden's temperature like? How does he feel about Wall going out? Wall coming in and Westbrook going out? Like, what do you make of the Rockets after, you know, just another round of just crazy movement?
I mean, this is, in all honesty, the hardest team to project heading into this season, in my opinion. I think they have the highest ceiling and the lowest floor, just like the range of outcomes for this group. And I'm factoring in the possibility that they will trade James Harden, obviously. And if they do that, then they will be just wretched. But I mean, you didn't mention also Boogie Cousins.
Well, who is, I mean, come on.
Well, it's just, I mean, you know, they said he looked good. I know it's a flyer, but that is someone who, I guess, aesthetically changes how they want to play if he gets minutes in the rotation, which I assume he will. I don't
can
know
I just get on my soapbox? Boogie Cousins is not the answer right now. I mean, come on. That's you're grasping at straws, right? Like, and it's not to demean him. It's not his fault. He's just had numerous very serious injuries. Even before the most recent one, you know, he was struggling from a mobility standpoint on the court. Fit-wise, does he do anything that you need for a player with Harden? I mean, it's arguably a worse fit than Dwight Howard was with James Harden. I'd say actually it is. If you're looking at which version of Howard you got versus which version of Cousins you're getting right now. It's exciting when you see that headline that your team signed him, but I don't think he's an impact-making player this year for Houston.
I don't think that Boogie Cousins is going to be the guy who, you know, was in conversations as the best post player in basketball and the best center in basketball. I mean, those days have clearly passed. But I just think he's someone that's good to have potentially on your roster, just no risk at all with the contract, and can be deployed in certain matchups. You know, there are big teams in the Western Conference. They're going to need big bodies. So, like, I think that this is just such a mystery. John Wall is a total mystery. I don't know how he's going to look. Even if he was 100%, the fit with Harden is not super clean. I think it honestly comes down to how they play basketball on both ends, which is also a mystery. Like, I could see them not doing the ISO heavy thing with Harden and trying to get him to buy in with off ball movement a little bit more, particularly with John Wall, who's had the ball in his hands as much as Harden has in his career, and is totally comfortable running high pick and rolls.
Let me hop in there real quick on the fit between Harden and John Wall. You know, you go from an excellent fit basketball-wise, from James Harden and Chris Paul. Those guys really fit well together. Now, they might not have liked each other. They might not have realized how well they fit together, but they did. You go from a great fit in those guys to, I would consider, a below-average fit with Westbrook and Harden. Now, I think you've gone even worse. I view John Wall and James Harden as an atrocious fit, right? I mean, Wall needs to have the ball in his hands. He's wanting to go up and down fast. He is wanting to orchestrate in the half court. He is often taking shots that he shouldn't be taking. And some of the same issues that Westbrook has, but he's not as explosive and not as powerful, you know, going to the basket. And, you know, James Harden's not going to want to watch and stand around and watch him do his thing in the half court. He's just not going to want to do that. When Harden has the ball and he's doing his thing one-on-one, you know, Wall is not spacing the court. He's not attracting attention. He's not an active off-ball player. In fact, he's like, you know, because of his injury history, he's one of the least active guys in the half court when the ball's not in his hands, right? He just kind of stands out there and essentially rests. I think it's going to be a lot of my turn, your turn, really ugly stuff between the two of them. You know, I have a hard time even picturing how you would approach it from an offensive standpoint. And I think that the other guys are going to be suffering from buy-in issues again, because you have two high-usage ball handlers. You have the architect of the entire scheme in Daryl Morey no longer there to kind of convince people to buy in. You've got guys who are angling for new contracts who probably haven't gotten them. And you've got guys who were on really, really good Rockets teams 2 years ago who are now looking around and saying, like, God, we have really fallen off. You know, it's like, geez. What's happened to us? I think the emotional ability to kind of keep everybody together, the locker room leadership stuff, the motivation factors and all that is going to be huge issues for them. So I don't see a good fit in the backcourt at all. Actually, I see a terrible fit, and I see no ceiling on this group. You know, I think that like their absolute best case to me is like the 7th seed in the Western Conference, and I think it's more likely than not they're a lottery team.
Okay. Well, I mean, you make totally logical points. I'm not going to deny that. I think that
I'm also coming at this from a place of frustration. I really liked those Rockets teams a couple years ago, right? And I just loved the idea, the audacity. They played the heel role really well. You know, hey, we've got spreadsheets that says the NBA is coming after us. It's like, this is what, I mean, you know, you just kind of need some of this stuff in your life. And I look at this group now, it's just like they're a dilapidated house, you know? Like the lawn is all screwed up, you know, the paint is chipping, there's a giant hole in the roof. I mean, it's just been absolutely destroyed. We need someone to go over there and flip that house and clean it back up, you know? And they can't turn back the clock, and the damage is already done. And if I'm Harden, I want out.
Well, yes, Harden does one out. I would say to, you know, alter your house metaphor real quick. I think that they're more like an evolving property. They're, you know, they are doing some handiwork around the margins and making it, you know, it's a fixer-upper right now. But I think when you add a piece like Wood, who just adds different dimensions to what you can do on both ends, ideally, it just, it changes the calculus here. I think Wall is a great passer.
Honest question. Yes. Has James Harden ever heard of Christian Wood or seen him before?
To quote Eric Gordon, you're going to have to ask James that question.
I'm just saying, he's not the savior here, right? Like, James Harden has had it really good in Houston. He's played on some awesome teams. You make this really nice, like, you know, basketball dork-approved move to go grab a Christian Wood. That's not a sales pitch to a guy like James Harden. When he's watching LeBron getting Anthony Davis and he's watching Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, he's dreaming about going to Brooklyn. He's like, you got me Christian Wood? You know, it's like getting socks for Christmas.
No, you're being rude. No, Christian Wood is good, and he brings an athletic dimension to the team that they haven't had. And
he is good, I'm saying James Harden has a different standard, is my point, right? Like, he just casually flipped Chris Paul for Russell Westbrook. Like, he's thinking big. He's used to having it all. He views himself as an MVP guy every single year. He probably thinks he should have 3 or 4 MVPs, right? Christian Wood, I mean, look, that's not... If you're trying to appeal to a James Harden who's got a couple years left on his contract, and you know the vultures are circling, and your big offseason move is Christian Wood and John Wall, I understand that James Harden doesn't have an agent. I would hope he has somebody in his corner telling him, like, come on, bro. You've got to do better than this. If you're trying to win a title, if everyone's putting the pressure on you to take the next step in your career, and they're calling you a playoff choker and everything else like that, you can't go to war with John Wall and Christian Wood in 2021.
I hear everything that you're saying. I think I want to see it on the court first, and maybe it'll be a total disaster. I'm an optimistic guy. I want to see, you know, you know, they've spent the last few years doing this switch everything scheme to mostly success, although there were some doldrums. I think now they're going to be a little bit more traditional with Wood, and particularly if Boogie gets minutes, I think they'll be, you know, in softer coverages. I'm just interested in seeing how it all plays out. I want to give Silas, the new coach, a chance. He oversaw the best offense in NBA history last season. Like, if Harden is willing to buy in and just, you know, take a deep breath and give it some time, like, maybe this thing can work. I mean, they still have the 3-point shooting. They still have really proven veterans on the team. If everyone just buys in for one more season, I think they could surprise some people.
Well, I love it, Michael. You're going down with the ship. I really appreciate it. Look, Steven Silas was there for the number one offense. I'm going to give Luka most of the credit. Here's the thing I keep coming back to. Do you remember at the end of the bubble when James Harden said they were just one piece away from being a contender?
Sure.
You know, that comment, I think it got a lot of snickers at the time, right? People are like, come on, bro. What one piece? You just got run off the court by the Lakers. What are you talking about? And, you know, I was thinking, well, that one piece was Chris Paul, and you traded him away the previous year, right? You look at what's happened since then. I just am curious, like, first of all, we don't know for sure if James Harden believed that when he said it. I think it was the right thing to say. But if you're Harden, you're looking around and saying, there's no possible way you can believe, even now, you're one piece away. You have to view this as a major step back. And you also have to see a lot of the other superstar guys around the league who you view as your peers, right? Getting what they want. LeBron, boom, big new contract extension. Anthony Davis, big new contract in Los Angeles. Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving put together the team up in Brooklyn. You kind of go right down the list. Guys are being taken care of and catered to, and that's sort of what you expect. And that's what you have come to expect in Houston for years, and that's just not the case right now, right? His relationship with this organization is changing. And so if Christian Wood comes out and he's an MVP, maybe you can talk me into it, but I don't see that happening. If John Wall comes out and blows the doors off everyone and makes an All-NBA team, then, you know, maybe he's happy. I don't see that happening either. And I think if I was Houston, I would really strongly consider, I've said this before, but I would strongly consider trading James Harden before the start of the season and just go forward with the rebuild. I get that that's not what their messaging is right now, but I would still, you know, really think hard about it. And remember, Houston told us they were willing to get uncomfortable, right? Well, they weren't that willing because they only got a first-round pick to take on John Wall's contract. So I think there was a level of desperation from their side to get rid of Westbrook in the short term. And I do think that does not bode well, kind of, I guess, for their big picture here.
I think, again, you make really good points. I want to say, like, if the Nets start out this season, like, firing on all cylinders with the best offense in the NBA, and Kyrie and KD are clicking, and Caris LeVert and Spencer Dinwiddie all make sense in their roles, like, there's no place for Harden to go. Like, the options aren't, like, they're just not there. So he has to say, like, the irony here is that he wanted to play this style, right, that made him a super duper offensive force, unprecedented in a lot of ways, just how he played, his style, his usage, the step backs, all of it. That made him not ideal to play with other superstars in a lot of ways. And so maybe some of the hesitation on a team like Brooklyn's part of breaking up what they have before they get to see what it is taking on Harden and having it fit in with Kyrie and KD and not having a lot of depth. Because, like, I just think that Harden has kind of made his own bed in a lot of ways, and now he has to sleep in it. And so what that means is you have to elevate guys like Christian Wood, who are super talented, who have, you know, he averaged 22-10 over a 15-game stretch. I think that was something. Shot 40% from the three-point line. He's like 6'10 with a 7'3 wingspan. That's something to work with. So if Harden is this great player, and I think he is a great player, like, great players elevate those around you, and, like, let's see it.
He made his own bed. 100% right. Look, this guy had a giant, king-size, top of the line waterbed, Posturepedic, all of it, and now he's sleeping on a cardboard 2x4, man. Like, this is a mess. What was he doing? Now he's sleeping in it. All right, we've been getting after these guys a little bit too hard. Let's pivot to who I mentioned earlier, LeBron and Anthony Davis, kind of re-upping with the Los Angeles Lakers. Now LeBron decides to sign a multi-year contract extension that will take him through 2023. The benefit for him there is he gets a little bit of a raise on next year's contract and adds another guaranteed year of salary. So if there was some worst case scenario with injury or age-related decline, he's covered and got himself a little bit more of a cushion and a cash out. As a lot of people noted, it also lines up his free agency with the possibility of his son Bronny coming into the NBA in the 2023 draft if the league changes its rules and allows preps to pros, players. In other words, going straight from high school. We also have news from Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN.com breaking here today on Thursday that AD is considering or very close to a five-year contract worth $180 million, basically taking every dollar that he can get with a player option at the end of that contract. There had been a lot of discussion, would he go for a two-year contract or a three-year contract to line it up with a certain amount of years of service and all that. Instead, it seems like he's just saying, look, I love LA. This is the place to be. There's no wandering eye here. Just go ahead and pencil me in as the franchise guy who's going to carry this organization after LeBron gets closer to his 40s. What do you make of this, Michael? I mean, these are pretty big moves, not totally anticipated either way. I think, we've come to expect LeBron wanting shorter term contracts to maximize his leverage. We probably thought AD was going to take a 2 or 3 year contract so that he could, follow a similar path. And instead, they're both locking up, for the foreseeable future and kind of erasing the possibility of any speculation or trade stuff or any of that for at least this coming season, if not another one after that. Big wins for the Lakers. Is there some downside that I'm not seeing here, Michael? What do you make of it?
I mean, it's obviously, they're both surprising. They're both huge wins for the Lakers. But I have a macro question for you that I want to pose that both of these contracts kind of have instigated in my brain. And it is basically like, how much really has the pandemic impacted or just made the NBA's economic picture that much more volatile to the point where, like, AD locking himself into a five-year deal is not something that, like, any star has basically done since the decision, really, that I can think of off the top of my head in terms of being in your prime and not wanting to maximize your salary and really limiting your own flexibility and your own decision-making power. LeBron is a little bit of a different situation because of his age, but that one still also surprised me because he could have entered free agency in 2021 next summer, and now it kind of hurts the Lakers. It doesn't really hurt. I guess it technically does hurt the Lakers in their ability to add a third star, where that path is just not there anymore, which, that's maybe not the biggest deal to a team that already has LeBron and AD. But, like, I guess my question is, how volatile is the league's economic, like, framework right now for these guys? Like, why did AD do this?
Well, I think, number one, he would not have done this, I don't think, if he was in New Orleans or just name any market, right? I think a big part of his decision-making is you're at a premier organization that has shown the ability to win a title and has also shown the ability to have its front office work very closely with your agent to, set things up for how you want it, right? Like, I think we should give credit not only to Rich Paul, but also to Rob Pelinka for being willing to kind of have that collaborative relationship. Not every front office would. And I think that LeBron and AD and all those clutch guys feel very empowered in Los Angeles, very comfortable. And I think that counts. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, I 100% believe the pandemic is influencing decisions like this. It was actually something that I had mentioned a couple of weeks ago. I'm not sure if we talked about this, but I was using it as the strongest argument that, Giannis might want to sign the Supermax. It's the same idea of just the crazy long-term financial uncertainty. The idea of having this flexibility year to year doesn't sound so great if you're worried about a potential lockout in a few years, right? Or if you're worried that the pandemic is going to wipe out 2.5 years worth of revenue and totally change the NBA's financial landscape. If you're worried about not having fans in buildings for the majority of two seasons, your mentality starts to shift. Like, look, I can't control a lot of things about life right now, during the pandemic. What I can control is maximizing my earning potential now and locking in as much money no matter what as I can. And so I think that that's where it kind of, changes people's priorities. And I think that's natural. It's not even just a basketball thing. Look, in times of great instability and tumult and, you know, the possibility of, you know, financial, you know, we had for a while there, a stock market crash. I think it's rebounded, you know, quite well. But I think anytime you've got that level of financial volatility, people are going to cling for stability where they can. And I think this is a good example of it. Now, were they going to sign up for some situation they didn't want to be in? No, I don't think so. I think that you would still get the advice from your agent, hey, do what's best for you, and let's at least keep some options open. I think in the case of AD, it's easier to make the case he should re-sign with the Lakers for 5 years. I still think with Giannis, and you're looking at some of the moves they made or didn't make, there's a little bit more risk there, right, to re-signing the Supermax, because now you're banking on Drew Holiday being able to be re-signed, right? You're banking on Chris Middleton for being a big-time player for the next 4 years. You're, you know, you're banking on the front office being able to find a longer-term Brook Lopez replacement down the road, right? It's not quite as you know, kumbaya as I get to play the next year, 2 years with LeBron, and then I get to be the face of the, you know, the highest profile league, organization in the league, which is what Anthony Davis is dealing with. So, you know, there are different decisions, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if Giannis reached a similar conclusion. And I think if I was an agent, in most cases, because there would be a lot of things I couldn't predict, and I would be really worried about a pending labor war down the road because of the massive financial losses these guys are taking, I would say get your money now.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think the most interesting perspective to view these transactions from is just, I think Anthony Davis is the most startling for me. So his alternative, the most popular alternative that I expected personally was for him to sign the 2+1, which would have allowed him to re-enter free agency with 10 years of experience and make him eligible for a max contract that is then 35% of the salary cap. Now, that's kind of the impetus for my question before about how much he and Rich Paul kind of saw the financial future of the league being murky to lock in this $190 million deal or whatever it is instead. But what I do also think is really fascinating, and it kind of speaks to what you were saying about being the face of the Lakers, and he must just really love that experience being in LA, et cetera. Like, just guaranteeing, like, you don't know. The NBA is so fluid, man. And, like, you don't know what the Lakers are going to look like in 2 years. And to when LeBron's contract expires and maybe he leaves to play with his son, like, all of a sudden, AD is under contract for another 2 years in his prime on a team that could be terrible. We don't know that. So that's the whole point of, if you're a great player, to have that flexibility for yourself to put the organization over a barrel to convince them and force them to make decisions that are in your best interest as the superstar. So, like, I'm not saying that the Lakers are about to get cheap or anything like that.
Well,
I am saying that I think that, you know, the jury is still out for me personally on how competent Rob Pelinka in that front office is in a post-LeBron universe.
No, I hear you, but the counter is this. He's got the most powerful agent in the NBA, and if Anthony Davis wants out of L.A., he's going to be able to get out of L.A. just like he got out of New Orleans, right? I mean, I don't think there's any situation where, you know, if Rich Paul and Anthony Davis decide, hey, this run is done, they're going to be able to orchestrate a deal. And I think that, number one, we see superstars move constantly in all sorts of different ways, so that's just become the standard. If guys want out, it's always in the organization's best interest to let them go and to kind of cash out as much as they possibly can. So I think that's the insurance policy. I think that if Anthony Davis is like, hey, Rich, like, I don't want to get stuck in a bad spot where, like, you know, we're going through a rebuild, Rich is like, don't worry, bro, I'll get you traded. It's fine. We already did it in New Orleans. It was no big deal. You know, it cost us like $25,000, whatever the fine was, and you had to wait 3 months, and then it got taken care of. So I think that is where the trust factor is coming from with Anthony Davis. And but you're right. 5 years is a long time. These teams go in cycles. They're going to look a lot different if LeBron does fall off a cliff from an age-related decline standpoint. And they're also locking in this five-year contract at sort of like the peak moment of Anthony Davis's career, right? He's probably never felt happier than he has, you know, since celebrating that title in October. And so that's always a little bit dangerous when you're making big decisions like that. But I don't see a ton of downside risk for him, because I do think that there's going to be a lot of teams who would line up to offer amazing trade packages for Anthony Davis. if he decided he wanted out.
West Coast bias is all I hear out of your mouth right now. But I also really want to quickly add that the Lakers will not have their first round pick in 2025. It belongs to the New Orleans Pelicans. And I believe in 2027, someone out there double check for me. But they have a lot of picks that are out the door owned by New Orleans as well. So I just think like rebuilding around Davis, you know, it's a problem that a lot of teams would love to have Anthony Davis in their prime. And you make a really good point about, sure, he can force his way out if he needs to. I think that the maybe like the optics of that were terrible when he did it the first time around, and would be doubly so if he turned his back on Laker Nation.
Let me ask you,
that's a bridge that they can cross when it gets there.
Anybody care about optics anymore? I feel like, look, and that's the thing. I think it's like the people who care about optics just have tuned out of the NBA, right? Because it's just like, look, guys are moving. They have too much power. It's not fair. Like, there's not a competitive landscape. The Lakers just hoard all the talent. The big market franchises always get the stars. So there's definitely fans who are watching what's happened here the last 5 years during the player empowerment era, and they're saying, I can't really cheer for my team anymore because I don't know who these players are. They move too fast. We can't keep our superstars. It's not fair. So those people are out. I feel like, I mean, what were the optics of the Russell Westbrook experience in Houston? They were terrible. It was there for 1 year. Did it stop anyone from doing anything, or did this the whole show just kind of go on? I mean, I don't know. Like, does optics matter? I guess that's my question. Is that influencing any of these guys' decisions? It sure doesn't feel like it. And I would say that if I'm Rich Paul and Anthony Davis, I'm like, yeah, we took a beating for a couple months, but he won a title. He just got a 5-year contract. We could negotiate any terms of any deal that we wanted. Let the haters eat cake, you know?
Let the haters. Can that be the name of this episode, please? I just real quick about like optics, which is like a whole different podcast episode. But like Kevin Durant is someone who obviously cares about optics. It is the reason why he went to the Brooklyn Nets, pretty much, and the reason why he went to the Golden State Warriors in the first place. So I think that they do still matter a little bit to some people, for sure. Anthony Davis was going to get his money regardless, for sure. I also think that we did have a conversation earlier when he did win the title where we were kind of like, are you emotionally invested in Anthony Davis winning this championship? Like, you're watching him cry on the court. And I don't think anyone, I don't know, I can't speak for everyone, because I'm sure a lot of Lakers fans were emotional about it, but like, the average NBA fan who's watching that is like, dude, you just forced your way there. Like, you're playing with LeBron, the best player ever, or at least of his generation. Like, why are you so emotional? Like, no one cares.
Right. No, I agree with you that they did not connect. This title team did not connect with the masses compared to some previous title teams. I guess my point is that, like, the actual people who are making these decisions, Anthony Davis, his agent, LeBron, I don't think they really care that much. I think they would rather just sign whatever contracts they want, win the title if they possibly can, and live in Los Angeles and have a good life. I'm pretty sure that those are their priorities, right? And they're just kind of hoping, you know what, like, if we get the do, we get the do. If not, you know, hopefully we can, like, you know, start our own media company and tell our own story in 2 years, right? You know, and that's kind of what they've done. So that's why I'm saying, like, this whole optics question is a tricky one, because I don't think it's as simple as, like, you know, guys wanting to alter their free agency decisions or their career paths solely to appease the public. I think those days are kind of done. All right, Michael, we should take some more questions here. We got one from Brady in Alaska. He writes, is it just me, or is this the best slate of Christmas Day games ever? Just looking at the teams involved, you've got all four conference finalists. You've got last year's best regular season team in the Bucks. You've got the dynasty of the past decade in the Warriors. You've got a major title favorite in the Clippers. You've got Kevin Durant's comeback on the Nets. You've got Luka's Mavericks, and you've got Zion's Pelicans. The only team that might feel snubbed either lost in the first round, which is the Sixers, or they lost in the second round and lost major pieces like the Toronto Raptors and Houston Rockets. So really, they have nothing to complain about. Plus, you've got a lot of great storylines. Luka versus LeBron, Kyrie versus the Celtics, and the bubble rematch of the comeback kids, the Denver Nuggets versus the Clippers. Obviously, the NBA always tries for marquee matchups on Christmas, but it seems like this year they were extra motivated to get it right with the late start and the empty arenas. I like this take from Brady in Alaska. First of all, we don't hear from Alaska very often, so I appreciate that, Brady. I'm glad you're checking us out. Second of all, I think he runs counter to a little bit of what I saw on NBA Twitter, which was I think a lot of people didn't particularly love these matchups, Michael. So I was curious, where did you come down on the Christmas Day slate?
I mean, hate is a strong word. I don't like these at all. I you know, you asked me to rank them, and I think we're probably going to do that in a minute, maybe. But like, I had a difficult time coming up with the number one. I don't, I mean, like, I'm going to watch all these games and enjoy them because that's who I am. But like, they could have done such a better job. So like, instead of ranking them, can I actually give you the matchups that they should have done with these same 10 teams?
Ooh, so you're just playing like musical chairs, basically.
That's exactly what I'm doing, except everyone gets a seat. Everyone's going to be happy.
Okay, so, let me hear it.
So the first game of the day, Heat Bucks. It's a rematch of the second round upset. Miami went to the finals eventually. You have the Giannis-Miami intrigue. It's just, it's rich in a lot of ways, and it, narratively speaking, and narrative kind of drives a lot of my motivations in these matchups, but like, the Heat just knocked off the Bucks in the second round. Like, why aren't they playing each other? Why are they? Why are the Heat playing the Pelicans in a basketball game? Like, that is so random. Like, do you agree with me?
The Heat Pelicans one stands out as making very little sense. It felt like
it's awful.
It's like the overflow game where, like, look, we have to put the Heat on because they made the conference or they made the finals. You know, we have to put the Pelicans on because they have Zion and he like somehow draws more television viewers than basically everyone. So we're just going to shove them together and call that the first matchup. I will say, though, I was relieved because do you know what I thought they were going to do?
What?
I thought they were going to try to appeal to like the hype beast generation. And I thought they were going to go Zion versus LaMelo for the opening game. And I thought they were going to just like go all in with the Ball Brothers storyline, maybe get LeVar like, you know, tier two access to an empty arena so he can cheer from the stands. Like, I was worried that they were going to go Hornets Pelicans. So I actually admire the restraint by the NBA of not putting LaMelo on Christmas, because I'm sure he would draw pretty big ratings just because of all the hype that he generated over the last couple of years. And I was mainly worried because of how much they milked Zion last year. I mean, put him on national TV like 10 of his first 14 games or something like that. That had me nervous. So I don't like their matchup. I do like the idea of Heat Bucks better. So far, you're one for one.
Okay, super. So, I mean, I can go on a little bit about why I think the Pelicans should not be there, but I'll just be like screaming into the wind because the Pelicans are going to be there because of Zion, so I'm not even going to entertain the alternative. But like, if I were the Blazers, I would be upset about this, but I just want to get that off my chest. But like,
I thought Portland and Philly were the two biggest snubs, and Houston, you know, questionable because they, I think they probably didn't know whether the trades were going to happen, so that was probably influencing the scheduling decision. Yeah. But yeah, I agree with you. Portland feels like a snub here. And if you're Lillard, you're like, you know, more fuel to the fire.
Yeah. Yeah. So instead of Pelicans Heat, I'm going to have the Pelicans play the Dallas Mavericks. And the reason here is pretty simple. We have the two best young players, two most exciting young players in the entire NBA, dueling for like on a national stage. Giving people a glimpse of what could be for the next 10 to 15 years. I mean, this just makes too much sense. I don't understand why this was not the matchup.
I hear what you're saying, Michael, but you just ruined the best game of the night, and you made it worse. The best game of the night was Luka versus LeBron. That was the one game I didn't want you to screw with. I didn't want you to touch it. I know everybody wants to have Lakers-Clippers for every big-time showcase showdown.
Yes.
I think
yes.
That was fine, and that you're maybe going there. I like the pivot. I like this idea of Luka coming off the bubble, hitting that insane game winner against the Clippers, having some really memorable head-to-head showdowns with LeBron, the fact that he idolizes LeBron, the fact that he's going to become the face of the NBA once LeBron fades. I set it up now. Let's get this push going. I felt like the NBA was slow to market Giannis when he was developing the last couple of years. I think Luka has earned the right to be on the absolute biggest stage. I think we've seen LeBron go head-to-head against KD and seen him go head-to-head against Kawhi enough. We've certainly seen him play Steph in a lot of big moments as well. I love the idea of LeBron versus Luka. So you screwed that one up, Michael. Thumbs down.
No. So Luka has not... does not deserve anything. He has how many playoff series has Luka Doncic won in his career?
Look, he's
Answer the question or let me go on with my argument.
Zero.
The answer is zero. Okay,
is he not an MVP caliber player?
He is, but he has not won a playoff series.
Wouldn't he make the conference finals in the East?
That is not the argument here. I think that you are, not you, I think that the schedule makers here are getting a little bit ahead of themselves with this type of matchup. I think that
you're late, Michael. They're right on schedule. You're late.
No. And I also, this is another hot take for a different episode, hopefully, that you let me kind of cook on, but I don't think the Mavericks are going to make the playoffs this year.
What?
So anyway, the next matchup that I have, and we don't need to go.
You slipped the best takes in with like 5 minutes to go on every episode. We're going to have to lead that episode next week. Okay, so give me the rest of your ideal matchups.
Right, so real quick, like Clippers Lakers. I love watching the Clippers and the Lakers. I mean, that's the best rivalry in the NBA. I don't care what anybody says. Like Kawhi versus LeBron is so sexy. And I want to see how the Clippers bounce back from just their total debacle. I know we're gonna get it on opening night, and that's wonderful. Christmas is a little different. It's a little special. And you know, you add the Montrezl Harrell beef. There's just a lot of different variables here that I really would love to watch, and I just think Clippers Lakers is like peak NBA basketball right now.
I hear you. Look, you can't go wrong with Kawhi LeBron, but at the same time, they used that for like every single big game last year, and the fact that they can't really do it back to back on opening night and Christmas, you have to kind of pick one. I like the idea of the Clippers having to watch the Lakers get their championship rings on ring night. I think that's kind of hilarious. And, you know, then you go from that to LeBron Luka. I just don't think you can top that. I love that matchup. And they were really fun, entertaining games last year. Luka gets up for it. And I also think Luka's going to be on a man on a mission this year. You know, guys like you trying to ride off the Mavericks are nuts. I think he's going to be, if not the MVP, top two this season when you're looking at who's going to bring energy in empty buildings and, you know, be able to hold up night after night, back-to-backs and all that stuff. I like his young legs being able to do that. I like just the fact that he'll play anywhere, anytime. And I want a statement. You know, I want a big-time statement on Christmas Day from Luka, and I'm hoping we get that. Okay, give me your last matchups here real quick, because there's only a few teams left, right?
Yeah, so the next one I have is, I think, Celtics-Nets is fine. That's really good. It would be a lot better if fans were allowed in TD Garden with alcoholic beverages and Kyrie Irving stepped on the court. Like, I think that that would be just the environment everybody wants on Christmas Day.
How is Tatum going to do in that matchup with KD? Is he coming out on top, Michael?
40 and 15. You think? No, that's definitely what he's going to average that for the rest of his career against KD. No, I think that, you know, that like these two organizations, they don't have like a real rivalry per se, but you have the Kyrie factor, you have you know, the fact that still that there was the trade that kind of rebuilt the Celtics on the fly, and or not on the fly, but let the Celtics accelerate a rebuild by getting all of Brooklyn's assets, and then Brooklyn turns around and says, we don't really care, we're gonna still sign your best player and Kevin Durant and maybe leapfrog you in the Eastern Conference. So I think that, you know, on the court, it's really fascinating. And then there's all the other stuff to kind of salivate over away from basketball.
This was my number two game. I actually would have preferred doing Nets Warriors on Christmas and just kind of flipping it, right? Have Nets Celtics on opening night and then have Nets Warriors on Christmas, just so you get the KD versus Steph storyline. But
yeah,
I think the NBA was probably thinking we need to spread out Steph, KD, and LeBron into different games. I think that was probably their strategy here. So, you know, that's probably why they landed where they did. So who was the last game in your lineup?
So the last one is just the two leftover teams. The Denver Nuggets, who I do not want to disrespect. I think they deserve a spot on Christmas Day. And the Golden State Warriors. I think, like, first of all, this is just a fascinating basketball matchup. Everyone wants to see Steph on the court again. Everyone wants to see, I think, you know, I wrote a piece last year comparing Jamal Murray with Steph and the way that Jamal was playing in the bubble and the shots he was hitting and how he was hitting them. I think that there's a parallel there. There's a parallel in terms of how both of these organizations were built, just like with patience and continuity and homegrown draft picks and all that. Like, that is awesome. So it could feel like a passing of the torch, to be honest, if the Nuggets were to topple Golden State. I think that would be a really cool game to watch.
Yeah, you talked me into that one. I would say that, do you remember a couple years ago when Draymond would kind of bully Jokic, you know, and try to mess with him and kind of, you know, keep him uncomfortable on the court? It's sort of like Jokic coming back after having gone through puberty. It's like, all right, now we're ready for this matchup. You know, it's like, he's not going to be intimidated anymore. He's going to win that one inside, like, pretty easily. That would be a good game. So just to run down real quick, the NBA's official schedule, I'm not sure if I did this earlier. It's Pelicans Heat. It's Warriors Bucks. It's Nets Celtics. It's Mavericks Lakers. It's Clippers Nuggets. To me, the best of those games is LeBron versus Luka. Next, you've got Tatum versus KD. That's pretty juicy. Next, I would go probably Warriors Bucks. It's a weird game. I think the NBA might be trying to say, hey, look, it's two homegrown superstars, Giannis and Steph. Yep. Not all of our guys move every single summer because they're probably two of the longest tenured guys in the league at this point. It's just a weird kind of cross-positional matchup between those two superstars. Doesn't really make a lot of sense. Fourth, I would go Clippers Nuggets. That was a pretty entertaining series, and the Clippers, I'm sure they're already sick of everybody writing them off and all the reports about their terrible chemistry and everything else, so I would expect them to come out motivated for that game. If they don't, write them off for the entire season, right? If they don't come out and win on Christmas, they're done. Okay, that's my take. And last but not least is Pelicans Heat. As you identified, that was the weakest link of the Christmas Day schedule. All right, Michael, I think we've reached the end of another episode of Open Floor. Thanks for letting me get all feisty today. Thanks for the great takes throughout. We want to hear what you guys have to say about the John Wall and Russell Westbrook trade. We want to hear what you have to think about the future of the Houston Rockets. Did James Harden make his bed, and is he now sleeping on a 2x4? Let us know. OpenFloorMail@gmail.com. OpenFloorMail@gmail.com. Michael's on Instagram and Twitter at Michael V as in Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golver, on Twitter at Ben Golver. You can find us on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. All right, Michael, until next week, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.